Hi, friends. Welcome to Neighborhood Church Podcast. Please go to neighborhoodchurchmn.org to find all the ways you can stay connected during COVID-19, or if you'd like to give. Please join us Sunday mornings, 10 a.m., where we stream our services on our webpage, as well as Facebook Live on our Neighborhood Church page. And if you happen to miss it, you could still go back and watch the services. Have a good and beautiful day. So friends, Neighborhood Church, this is Con Nguyen. And Con, why don't you share a little bit about yourself before we, Con prepared a video and it's great. And so before the video, I wanted you guys to meet Con Nguyen. So Con, why don't you share a little bit about yourself?
Well, yes, thank you, Pastor Chris, for inviting me, first of all. This is really such an honor and blessing to be able to share my story, and I don't want to reveal too much. I have a little bit of my story in the sermon, but I am married to David for about 13 years now. We have two children. Mi Lin is my daughter. She's 11. And Kwa is 9, my son. And they attend a Chinese immersion school, and we are Vietnamese. So their Chinese is actually better than their Vietnamese, and they like to talk behind our backs in Chinese. So it's pretty scary how they're growing in that language, but such a blessing too. We live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I think in your introduction, I founded my own business and ministry called Cultural Competency Consulting. And I love the way you put it in your post. I educate and train people on culture and race issues, immigration and Asian American issues. I've been a professor, a missionary, all over the world. I've sent teams all over the world and traveled. And so, you know, God has really blessed me with being able to experience so many different cultures, the good and the challenge of, you know, in this time, there is a lot of racial tension. And I feel that God has put in me a passion to educate people about that, because we are so undereducated and miseducated about a lot of these issues. So, I'm just so happy to be with your church this morning. And I hope you're blessed by what the Lord has laid on my heart to share. And I would love to meet some of you afterwards, too.
Awesome. Great. Well, we are going to play her video. And again, you can join us for the follow-up after. And then Sarah's going to be doing some worship at the end as well. All right, let me see if I can, I know I can do this. All right. Hello, friends.
April 30, 1975. Does anyone know what happened on this date in world history? This was the fall of Saigon, the end of the war in Vietnam, but it was the beginning of my family's journey to escape Vietnam. I was born in Da Lat in central Vietnam. I was only 3 at the time we escaped, so I have no memories of the events, but my mom always recounts them to make sure we remember where we came from. The North Vietnamese army was coming down and people would flee towards the coastal cities. It took 12 hours to go just 6 miles because there were so many people trying to leave. Rockets were shooting over the town and the people were running out of the city. We took a boat down to the southern coast, to Saigon, the last stronghold, the capital of the South. Now, when we heard the South had surrendered, my two uncles and my late father planned the escape. They paid for a boat to take us out of Vietnam. Both my father and uncle were connected to the government or the South Vietnamese army, so it would not have been safe for them to stay behind. My uncle had to leave his wife and 5 kids behind. There were about 45 people on this boat. And my mom always recounts the story of us getting caught in a whirlpool Our fishing boat was spinning around uncontrollably. My cousin recalls men screaming, "Tie the women and children down." And the wind was blowing so hard, it felt like her skin was falling off her face. My mom had to hold my brother and I down with each arm so that we would not fall off the boat. And the cable had broken that sent electricity to the motor. And miraculously, somehow my uncle clamped that cable together and we got out of the whirlpool. After 5 days and five nights at sea, we ended up in a refugee camp in Singapore. We were one of the fortunate ones who didn't drown at sea or get caught by pirates who stole from, raped, or killed refugees. Now, at that time, churches in the U.S. were sponsoring refugees over, and we were sponsored by a family in Minnesota. And I want to show you a picture of the family that sponsored my family. They were Tom and Doris Moody, and here they are, and with my family of four. And you see me taking my first taste of popcorn. Now, my first childhood memory was actually going home from the airport. And my mom had told me that on the plane ride over, my brother was always throwing up, but that didn't happen to me. But when we were driving home, I was sitting on Mrs. Moody's lap in the front seat of the car. And when we parked in the garage, you know, when a car stops and it has that slight jerk? Well, when it jerked, everything came out. And I threw up all over Mrs. Moody's lap. She was probably thinking, is this the thanks I get for bringing you to Minnesota? And my mom had told me that she screamed, "She vomited on me." Well, they helped us settle in a foreign land, got my father a job, got us housing, took us to church, and introduced us to the gospel of Jesus Christ. When we were hungry, they fed us. When we were thirsty, they gave us a drink. When we were strangers, they took us in. And today, I have the honor and blessing of working alongside Central African refugees, another wave of victims of war. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about my life and heart for immigrants. All these experiences have shaped my understanding of what it means to be an immigrant. I realize it's a very contentious issue for a long time in the US, and it's only gotten worse. But sadly, a Lifeway survey says that only 1 in 10 evangelical Christians actually look to the Bible to guide them on issues of immigration. And only 2% of Christians have ever heard a sermon preached about this topic. So congratulations for being part of that 2%. So what does the Bible have to say about immigrants? Well, a lot. Can you think of who was an immigrant in the Bible? Abraham was called to leave Ur and go to Canaan. Ruth was a Moabite, and she went to Israel due to famine. Joseph was a victim of human trafficking. His father Jacob and his brothers migrated to Egypt because of famine. David was an asylee when he fled from Saul, seeking protection from the king of Moab. And Jesus himself was a refugee, fleeing the persecution of Herod into Egypt. Now, when Abram was called to migrate out of Ur, God would promise him the land and nation of Israel. But first, they had to go through slavery in Egypt. Now, Moses leads them to migrate out of Egypt toward the promised land. And it says in scripture that a mixed company goes with them. So God gives them guidelines and laws to set up their society and also how to teaches them how to treat the foreigners. Now, there are several words used for foreigner in the Old Testament, but the most common is the Hebrew word ger. It is used 92 times in the Old Testament. It's translated as foreigner, sojourner, stranger, or alien. And it's used particularly for those who wanted to live among the Israelites. Don't worry, I won't go through all 92 references, but I will categorize the commands into three groups. So God calls Israel to provide for the foreigners, protect them, and create a place for them. First of all, provide for them. I'll just read the words and you can see the references on the screen. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. Do not take advantage of a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether that worker is a fellow Israelite or a foreigner. Pay them their wages each day before sunset, because they are poor and are counting on it. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God. Have you heard of this practice of gleaning? It's when harvesters would leave the corners left over for the poor so they could provide for themselves. Does this have any parallels for today's world as we think of the migrants working in our fields? And can you think of anyone who gleaned in the Old Testament? Yeah, Ruth was a gleaner. She not only found food, but found a husband gleaning. Because, you know, they didn't have dating apps like Match.com back then. They just had gleaning. In Leviticus, if any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, help them as you would a foreigner and stranger, so they can continue to live among you. So Israel was to provide basic needs and work for the foreigner. Secondly, Israel was called to protect foreigners. Do not take advantage of a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether that worker is a fellow Israelite or a foreigner. You are to have the same law for the foreigner and the native born. I am the Lord your God. These six towns will be a place of refuge for Israelites and for foreigners residing among them, so that anyone who has killed another accidentally can flee there. Cursed is anyone who withholds justice from the foreigner, the fatherless, or the widow. So, make just laws and cities of refuge to protect the humanity and rights of foreigners. Thirdly, Israel was called to create a place for foreigners. Be joyful at your festival, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levites, the foreigners, the fatherless, and the widows. Assemble the people, men, women, and children, and the foreigners, so they can listen and learn to fear the Lord your God and follow carefully all the words of this law. So, if a foreigner wants to celebrate feasts, join in worship, and follow the Lord, they should be allowed a place. You are to distribute this land among yourselves according to the tribes of Israel. You are to allot it as an inheritance for yourselves and for the foreigners residing among you. You are to consider them as native-born Israelites. Here, Ezekiel sees a vision of how the Lord intends to divide the land to Israel, to give them an inheritance and a place to live among the tribes. So in summary, provide for the foreigner, protect the foreigner, and give place for the foreigner. But why was Israel to do these things? Many of these verses end like this: do not oppress an alien. You yourselves know how it feels to be foreigners, because you were foreigners in Egypt. Remember that you were foreigners in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. So God is reminding Israel, you know how it feels to be treated unjustly. Don't forget how hard it was to be a foreigner. Another reason God says, bring all the tithes of that year's produce so that the foreigners may come and eat and be satisfied. Why? So that the Lord your God may bless you. But unfortunately, even after warnings from Old Testament prophets, Israel was judged and sent into exile because of their idolatry and sins, which included not caring for the poor or foreigner and denying them justice. And above all, God's reason to treat the foreigner is this in Leviticus 19:34. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as you love yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. This is the heart of God, the character of God, who calls Israel to love, because God is a God of love, the one who advocates for the most vulnerable in society. Now, how does the Old Testament speak to us today in America? Now, we are not Israel or a theocracy, but we can still live out the heart and love of God by providing for foreigners, protecting them, and creating a place for them. Today, the world is facing its largest refugee crisis since World War II. The United Nations defines a refugee as someone who has been forced to flee his or her country because of persecution, war, or violence. So let's view this video to get a glimpse of what is happening in the world today.
You adrift on the sea for 3 days, and certainly it was very difficult to know during that time whether we're going to survive.
Oh, God. You look at Homs and Aleppo in Syria. Vietnam looked like that after the war.
I am the child of Vietnamese refugees who arrived prior to 1975.
My family together with 40 others escaped from Vietnam on a very small fishing boat to the Indonesia. It took 14 days.
My mother made all of us keep a backpack, and in it was an address of an aunt in San Francisco, just in case we got lost from each other.
My dad couldn't afford to tell everyone that he had sent me off. He said that, you know, wherever you go, remember who you are. Sonny Lays, it's not just your name, it's my name too. And your grandpa's the name, so don't mess it up.
My parents did not let my grandparents know that we were escape. And I could see that my mother never forgave herself for leaving her parents behind. It's too difficult for me to.
There was no looking back. Certainly there was no looking back for us at that time.
Whenever I hear that the Vietnamese resettlement was the last global resettlement of its kind, it's frightening because it's not like there are no more refugees. I have this fear that there are millions of people out there who don't have the resources that we benefited from and that I feel we gave back to.
When I saw the picture of the little boys on the beach in Turkey, that is really bring back a lot of sad and horrifying memories.
No one would undertake that decision lightly, no matter what. How is it that you can hold on to two children and a wife and try to steer a boat at the same time?
If you look today, I'm in Syria, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan. Those people wouldn't have left hadn't been for regional conflicts, of which the U.S. has a hand in.
I truly believe all the nations that support the war are the nations that are responsible and should have the moral obligation to resettle all these refugees.
The visas get people in, but the resources that's necessary, all of that, somebody got to calculate quickly and really give a solution based on what we can afford or what we think our conscience can afford.
There are over 65 million displaced people and 23 million refugees worldwide today, the highest number ever seen. Since 1975, the U.S. has resettled 3 million refugees, and we had been a leader in the world. The previous two administrations allowed up to 110,000 refugees a year into the U.S. However, this current president has lowered that allowance to 50,000 in 2017. In 2018, he lowered it to 45,000, and last year, down to a dismal 18,000. That is the lowest number since the Refugee Act of the 80s. His executive order stated, "I hereby proclaim that the entry of more than 50,000 refugees would be detrimental to the interests of the United States." And he claims, "We don't know who they are." But we do know who they are, because previously refugees have been the most vetted category of immigrants. They can't just pick up and tell us where they want to go. They have to go through a rigorous process through 5 different federal agencies like the FBI and Homeland Security, and it takes from 18 months to 2 years to get processed. By the way, in 2017, a government report found that in the past decade, refugees have contributed $63 billion more in tax revenue than they cost in public benefits. The refugees who I grew up with and who I work with today are not detrimental. Pastor Justin Biaquelli is the pastor of the African church I work with. He's from the Congo in Central Africa. And since war broke out there, there are about 1 million refugees from there. Pastor Justin was an official in the government and had to be evacuated by the United Nations. In 2011, he established SEEDS, his refugee agency. He goes back and forth to refugee camps in Africa and brings refugees here, helps them find jobs, housing, education, and most importantly, a place to worship together. These Africans have suffered through war, rape, torture, PTSD. Some of my friends have spent 17 years in refugee camps. Pastor Justin once wrote a letter to the State Department of the US government saying that America has made a mess in the Congo, so what are you gonna do about it? So they agreed to receive 50,000 refugees from the Congo. Now, I wonder who this man is that goes to United Nations meetings, he's friends with the most recent Nobel Peace Prize winner from the Congo, and yet he is so humble. And what a great example of a refugee providing for other refugees. Refugees are actually a very small portion of the overall immigrant population. So let's deal with the elephant in the room, the so-called illegal immigrants. I prefer undocumented because no human should have the label illegal. Undocumented refers only to their legal status, not their humanity and worth, because they are made in the image of God. First, we do need to recognize that, yes, we are called to submit to our governing authorities and laws, and I don't advocate for chaos or complete open borders. But should we follow laws blindly? If everyone followed laws blindly, we wouldn't have the Hebrew midwives rescuing baby boys from slaughter. We wouldn't have Jesus breaking the Sabbath laws in order to heal the sick. We wouldn't have Peter and the apostles saying, we must obey God rather than man. We wouldn't have Jews being hid from Nazis. We wouldn't have the civil rights movement. We wouldn't have Nelson Mandela. I think we need to ask deeper questions, not just what is the law, but who gets to make these laws and who benefits? And has the legal way always been the just way? So let's take a quick stroll down the history of immigration laws in the US. But first let's ask, who were the first illegal immigrants? Maybe we should ask that to the Native Americans. I would submit that this problem started in 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. The European colonizers did not come with visas in hand, but eventually they took the land and made laws that benefited themselves. And centuries later, some of us have benefited from those laws and some have been restricted. So let's look at some specific immigration laws that have shaped our history. So, from 1790 to 1866, only white land-owning men could gain citizenship. In 1848, after the Mexican-American War, the US took over the southwestern states. Many considered this a very unjust war. Basically, a bigger power took over a smaller power's land. And we took over their land, and now we won't let them in. In 1882 through 1943, have you heard of the Chinese Exclusion Act? Well, that's what it did. It excluded Chinese from citizenship. We had them come over to build our railroads at very cheap labor, but denied them citizenship. Does that sound familiar today? How many of your ancestors came over through Ellis Island? Well, in 1880 through 1920, Ellis Island let in 23.4 million Europeans. No visas were needed. So if any of your ancestors came that way, they had it easy, and so eventually did you. Then after that, there was an anti-immigrant backlash. So in 1924, quotas only allowed Northern Europeans in, but banned most Asians and Africans. And then during the civil rights era, a 1968 act eliminated these racist restrictions on Asian and African immigration. So now in the present, in 2017, we have the controversy over the Muslim bans and the present crisis of families separated at the southern border. So who got to make these laws and who benefits from them? Let's take a look at authorized ways to enter the US. Now, there are only 5 main ways to gain legal status in the US. We've talked about refugees, but there are also those seeking asylum from political persecution or torture, such as my dear friend, Pastor Mike, who fled torture from the Congo around 7 years ago, leaving his family behind. And he is still here in limbo, trying to get through all these court cases. The next category is STEM. This is for highly skilled and highly educated workers in the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics field. Then there's family reunification. So if you have family abroad and want to bring them over, you can apply. But depending on what country they're coming from, it could take up to 20 years to get through that process. And then lastly, the diversity lottery is basically you put your name in a lottery and you get picked from a country that is trying to diversify the US. And for example, my mom's housemate is actually from Rwanda, and she was lucky enough to get picked to come here. So even now, the current administration wants to cut down on illegal immigration, but they also want to cut down on these 5 categories of legal immigration. So if you haven't noticed yet, for low-skilled workers and the uneducated, there is no legal pathway to get here. There is simply no line that they can get in. They are gleaning in our fields, cleaning in our restaurants, working in our hotels, doing jobs that Americans don't want to do. And contrary to popular myth, by far and wide, they are not criminals. They do pay many taxes and they complement the US workforce. But our labor laws are very outdated and don't fit the needs of our 21st century economy. Now, I don't want to make it sound like it's such a simple issue, like let them all in or keep them all out. There are many complications that need to be worked through. And I realize it's not so cut and dry, so black and white. Life isn't always so black and white because sometimes it's Asian. Seriously though, I think we as Christians can speak truth to power, protect immigrants, and say, let's base our laws on generosity and justice. Now, many came through the compassion of the government, as we Vietnamese did, and many citizens had it the easy way. So I find it so disturbing that these same people want to make it harder on those who want to come now. Romans 13 is the passage many Christians love to use to show we must obey the law. But if you keep reading further, it says in verse 10, love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Love is the fulfillment of the law. So if you only see this issue through a legal lens, then you're merely being legalistic. But if we see this through the lens of love, then we are fulfilling the law. If the legal way is not the just way, then it is not the Jesus way. If the legal way is not the just way, then it is not the Jesus way. Martin Luther King Jr. also said, the church must be the conscience of the state, the guide and the critic of the state, and never its tool. The church must recapture its prophetic zeal. Now, I don't want to get too detailed about policy. If you're interested, please check out resources like World Relief, a national Christian refugee ministry that advocates for a bipartisan solution, balancing law and security with justice and compassion. But what I do suggest is at least do not base our views by stereotyping Mexicans as drug dealers, criminals, and rapists, or Muslims as terrorists, or scapegoating immigrants as threats to our economy, or base views on white nationalism, supremacy, and racism. But sadly, this hostile rhetoric has increased, even in the Christian community. If you remember in East Germany, the communists built a wall to keep people in. Now we capitalists want to build a wall to keep people out. But the scriptures declare that Christ came to tear down walls of hostility between people groups, between Jew and Greek, male and female, Mexican and American, Black and white, Japanese and Korean, North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese, and undocumented and documented. Allow me to talk about one more category of foreigner found in the New Testament. We are called to practice hospitality. Now, this word is translated from the Greek word philoxenia. It has two parts to this word. Phileo means love, and xenos means stranger. So hospitality means love of strangers. Contrast that with xenophobia, which means an unfounded fear or hatred of foreigners. I learned so much from my African friends. I love asking recent immigrants what they see as the biggest difference between America and from their place of origin. I'd asked this to a dear family who had just come from the Congo to Minnesota for 6 months. And the daughter responded, "Where we come from, when we move to a new neighborhood, all the neighborhood people come out to welcome us and bring food, and we take care of each other's children. Here, I never see my neighbors. Where are they? Why don't they come out? How will the single people ever get married?" Well, I suppose they could learn to glean. So this family moved to a new home in St. Paul, and they were having a barbecue for a birthday party, and I was in their kitchen, and there was tons of food, and I asked them, "Where are you going to grill? In the backyard?" And they said, "No, in the front yard. In case any neighbors come by, they can have some food." What a true example of hospitality. Now, foreigners have come to America looking for a place in this world. And I've been reading about how Duluth has been debating this issue too. Not sure where all of that has landed, but how should we respond? Let's consider 1 Peter 2:9-12. "But you are a chosen people, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into this wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the unbelievers that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." Christians have a nation in God. We are a people of God on the one hand. Yet on the other hand, we are still foreigners in this culture. Peter was addressing Christians who were migrants dispersed all over Asia Minor. They were called foreigners because they were alienated for their faith. Just as God reminded the Israelites that they were once foreigners, God reminds us that we too were foreigners without a place in this world. We too needed mercy. One version says it this way: "You are chosen and honored by God, even as outcasts in the minority." Maybe you came to America as an immigrant and know how it feels not to fit in. Even if many of you were born here, somewhere down the line, your ancestors were immigrants struggling to make it in a new land. Some have been born here, but have been treated as outcasts. Perhaps that's why they need to cry out, "Black Lives Matter," because their community has been treated as if they don't matter, as if they are second-class citizens. Maybe your neighbors have been relegated to Fond du Lac Reservation Camp, treated as foreigners and outcasts on their own land. We have vulnerable people among us, and if America won't protect them, provide for them, or give them a place, then the church needs to rise up. And maybe God is calling your church to welcome them. Will your church embrace them? Will your church live such good lives and do such good deeds that others would glorify God? Let me wrap up with one more story. One summer, Pastor Justin asked me to go to the airport to greet a new family from the Congo. I thought this would be a good experience for my children. We made welcome signs in English and Swahili. Karibu means welcome in Swahili. We drew pictures, a picture of Africa and Minnesota. I learned later that this family, the father, during the war, was targeted and imprisoned by soldiers because he was shielding innocent farmers. When released, he had to go into hiding to avoid getting killed. Some of his family members survived being poisoned. They lived in scarcity for 6 years in a Ugandan refugee camp before being reunited with their friend, Pastor Justin. 1 week after arriving to the U.S., the children, who are gifted musicians, led the African congregation in worship and now do so every week. These are not weak refugees coming here to suck our resources as if they have nothing to give. These refugees are not detrimental to the U.S. They are strong, they are gifted, they are faithful. And maybe we need them to show us how to live again, to regain our soul. For what does it profit us if America claims to be the greatest on earth, yet has lost its soul? If America wants to be first, we have to learn to be last and learn from those who are considered last in this world. So as this family came to the baggage claim area, some of the teenage boys just immediately grabbed my children's hands and were playing with them. And one by one, I met all the children. And as I walked towards the mother, I just started tearing up for some reason. Maybe I was sensing something in my spirit. She introduced herself to me saying, "My name is Kitumaini. It means hope." "That's my mother's name," I told her. And then she says to me, "I am your mother," opens her arms up and gives me this huge embrace. I continued to cry off and on from the airport to the parking lot that day. They were probably wondering, who's this crazy Asian lady who can't keep it together? But I think the spirit was just showing me that my life had come full circle. I hope you see the irony in this situation. This foreigner, having just arrived, extended her arms to me to embrace me, a U.S. citizen, and welcome me into her family. Is that not what hospitality is? Is that not the gospel? That's the good news of the kingdom, the good news of Jesus. This Jesus was a dark-skinned, Middle Eastern, low-skilled carpentry worker, persecuted ethnic minority, descendant of slaves, refugee with no money to his name. Categories that would not get him into this nation or are despised by white nationalism. If you don't know this Jesus, he invites you to find your place in an utterly different kind of nation. When we follow this Jesus, we are no longer alone. His death on the cross takes away our sin and shame, and resurrection gives us a new life. We find a new belonging, a new community, a new commitment, a new status. We show mercy to others because God has showed mercy to us. We do good to foreigners, even if it puts us at odds with a xenophobic culture. We don't pledge allegiance to any nation. We pledge allegiance to King Jesus. We no longer live to advance this tiny kingdom of the U.S., but we live to advance the kingdom of God on earth. We love our neighbor, not pick and choose who our neighbor will be based on their economic impact to our country. This is Jesus' invitation to live out his kingdom. In this kingdom, we don't enter through any merit-based system of our own, but by the finished work of Jesus. In this kingdom, to be a citizen, you don't need a work visa. But what you do need is a passport stamped with the blood of Christ. And when you have that stamp, he declares, "We are no longer foreigners. We're family. We are no longer foreigners. We're family." So Lord Jesus, thank you for welcoming us into your family. And may we open our arms to welcome those that need a new family. Amen.
That was good. That was, thank you, Khan, thank you. That was an incredible message. Thank you. I think I could speak for our church. I feel very honored that we got to be in the space with you and to hear your story. Yeah, I that was some very good preaching, and we need to hear that. And we as a church, that's who we want to be. We want to be the people who can say, like, I can be your father, I can be your mother. But we see you, we recognize you, we embrace you. God, that was good. I was not ready for that, friend. I was not ready. So to wrap things up, we're going to have Sarah's going to lead us in a song and read a poem as a way for us just to reflect and to hear the Holy Spirit and to identify where the divine is pressing in on us and how we can grow.
I almost don't want to say anything. I want to just sit in silence for 20 minutes minimum. Yeah, thank you, Con. I'm also going to read two poems because I like to keep people on their toes. To hear, "Let us love them," brings me confusion. For how can I love them when there is only us? To whom do you refer as them? No thing can separate us from the love of Christ, for the love of Christ is us. There is no them. There is no them. There is no them. Let us love us. Let us love us. Let us love us.
lucky souls. We're bruised but blessed. We're arm in arm, we're stumbling west. And I was born to love you. Oh, I was born to love you.
You are here. Notice. You are a physical being. Notice. You have a body. You have a mind. Both limited to their nourishment. You are spirit. Notice. You have access to the divine. You have every complex emotion. You have strength, resilience. But more than anything, you have love. You have this. You are love. You are this. Breathe in. Breathe out. This is all there is.
Thank you, Sarah. All right, friends. Well, thank you for joining us today. And again, thank you to Khan. That was an amazing, amazing word. I would encourage you to feel free to share this when it's done. So more people can watch it 100 more times. Yeah. And if you'd like to, you can go to our website, neighborhoodchurchmn.org, to get the link to the follow-up, which we'll be starting here in a couple minutes. Have a great day, friends.